I am Sheen, a scientist, social entrepreneur, Oxford and Cambridge graduate, and you are listening to Dream Girl, my weekly podcast where I chat to incredible women about their journey, career choices, and generally about being awesome. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dream Girl. I am Sheen, and today my guest is Eleonor. So I know Eleonor from Material Science Department. We are both PhD students there. I recently finished my PhD, and Eleonor is in the process of finishing her first year of her PhD in superalloys, which sounds super interesting. We'll find out more about this. But I think the most interesting things about Eleonor is that she is a career astronaut candidate for Advancing X, and she's an analog astronaut for Asclepios. And I'm very excited to hear all about the space chat, because that's very different from being a material scientist. So why don't we just jumpstart this chat? Hi, Elo.
Hi, Sheen.
How are you today?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm good. So, I mean, obviously, thank you for being here today. We're going to have a little chat. So your Viva just happened this week. How did it go? How do you feel?
Half relieved, half worried. I had to have to correct a few things in the report, and because of COVID-19, I have to perform a few extra experiments to complete the report. So it was really great to have a different input than that of my supervisor, my sponsor for my PhD, to find a different way to tackle the problems that I'm looking at in my research. Mm-hmm. So this is always positive. Always get feedback, always try to learn some more. And in a PhD, you can often spend a long time without getting feedback from other people than your supervisor or even colleagues. So having a feedback from professionals in the field is very, very enlightening. It's a very good process to go through. Although it can be very tough and very stressful to prepare.
Oh yes, I can imagine. I mean, I've just been through one. So. But tell me, what's your PhD about actually? What superalloys? What do you do?
So I'm working on gas turbines, and basically we're trying to understand why some coatings fail on the turbine blades. The turbine blades are subjected to very high temperatures and to hot corrosion due to the components that are actually present in the turbine. And when you have turbines down offshore, then you also have some sodium sulfate, so sea salt, which basically attacks the turbine blade even further. And the coatings that we have are supposed to protect them, but they tend to fail, and we do not understand why.
Oh, great.
So it is my job to take samples of the material that they want me to test and put it in what we called a rig, which is composed of a furnace with some gas mixes that we can put in it, a bit of salt, and we can create some stresses to try and simulate a turbine environment. And once the material is cracked, I'm supposed to take it out and analyze and try to understand what are the different chemical species that are responsible for this corrosion and how they actually interacted with the stresses inside the blade and how it propagated the cracks inside the coating.
Right, so these are turbines for boats.
Right. No, these are turbines for power generation.
Actually. Oh, gosh, okay.
Bad guys.
Oh, la, la. So what got you interested in that?
Actually, I was interested in doing research at the University of Cambridge. I applied 2 years ago. Was it 2 years ago? Yeah, it was 2 years ago. I applied in Cambridge as a joke because I never thought I would get in.
Because that's a funny joke, right?
And I applied to do a master's, and somebody, one of the professors, saw my profile and offered me a fully funded PhD, although I was still not done with my bachelor's degree. And I looked at the subject and I was like, well, yeah, that looks great. So my master's was actually on thermal biocoatings, which are ceramics, and I was plasma spraying them on superalloys also.
Oh.
And I was basically trying to make some thermal biocoatings that were corrosion resistant as well as thermal resistant, and also who had elastic behavior that was quite similar to that of the substrate, so that it wouldn't crack when you have what we call thermal cycling. And what was amazing is I was working in a plasma spraying machine, so it looks like a submarine. And when you spray
I think I've seen it in your lab. Yeah,
it's fantastic. So it's a plasma flame, and so you're supposed to wear goggles or to protect yourself because you can become blind.
Oh, geez.
And it goes to like about, I don't know, 13,000 degrees.
Oh gosh.
And it looks like a little sun, so it's like really purple around the window. So there's a window, you can see through it, so with protections,
of course.
It looks so beautiful. It's amazing. And it's a very old piece of kit. It's about 45 years old. And it's so big and you operate it. You feel like you're in Chernobyl and you're one of those nuclear scientists. It's amazing. It's so much fun. So that's how I got into it, actually.
And so you still use this?
I don't use it anymore because I'm not producing those coatings anymore. Okay. The coatings I work on are metal based and not ceramic based anymore. But it's, it was fun while it lasted.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I forgot to mention that Elo is French, Italian, British and Swiss. So that's pretty cool. So you did your undergrad in Switzerland.
Yes.
Was that material science?
Yes, I was born in Switzerland and I did my undergrad there. And in Switzerland, basically, we don't have just material science. Mm-hmm. We have faculties that are separated in math, chemistry, physics, and I think, life sciences. These are what we called base science, what I think you guys would call natural sciences, except we don't choose our classes. It's all like prepared for us. It's prepared. You can't choose anything. Mm. And I did what we call engineering and material science. So it's both material science and a lot of engineering. And then I went to another university in Switzerland. So I first did it in French and English in Lausanne at EPFL. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Zedalhave, which is in Winterthur, not too far from Zurich. So I did it then in German and Swiss German. And there I did mechanical engineering with, specialization.
Specialization.
Exactly. Vertiefungs. And what we call process and material sciences. So like you do what we call chemical processes and you do lots of mechanical engineering with controls and electronics and thematic and So
you're telling me you studied science in French, German and English?
Yes.
So the terms must get very confusing for you.
Yes, the worst was when actually I worked in an aircraft company, Pilatus Aircraft, and it was before I actually moved to Swiss Germany, and I had to work in French, English, and German, and most people from the production type, they actually speak only German or Swiss German. And I didn't know how you would say, I now only know the word in German, I think, a tensile test.
Okay.
So in French, that is a traction, and in German, it's Zugfestigkeit test.
Oh, lovely.
And what is amazing with German is extremely precise. So when you're an engineer, writing a report is the first time very difficult, the second time very difficult, the third time amazing because all the words are so precise. You find exactly what you need. And this is extremely satisfying.
Yeah, especially when you leave French behind where nothing is precise. No.
But yes, it's sometimes difficult. So when I had my interview for my master's in Cambridge, I was asked what happens when you have a different thermal expansion coefficient on the coating on a turbine blade and it cools down. And I wanted to say there's a shear stress and I couldn't find a word. So I said, it's Zugspannung. I just had to simulate the movement of sheer stress because I had...
You were like, where's the dictionary?
I couldn't remember. I didn't even remember it in French. I just remembered it in German. I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to do a master's here. I can't even speak English.
You should have just said, this is the word in German. Can I Google it?
I could have. But I still got the job. So
there you go. You were here. So they were impressed. So, I mean, maybe it's time to address the elephant in the room.
The astronaut suited elephant.
So tell me, space, this is so different. I've never met anyone else who's been interested in space seriously other than kids. For everyone who can't see, Eleonora is currently wearing a necklace with a little astronaut on it. It's very cute. So tell me why, how, when did it all start? What was the inspiration behind it?
So as a little kid, I was always fascinated by science. I always read lots of books about science. I was crazy about submarines and stars. And usually engineering. And when I was about 8 or 9, I wanted to be either an environmental engineer, an astrophysicist, or a hairdresser.
Lovely. Almost the same things.
I just had this. And I thought about, people were talking about astronauts. And I thought, well, this is for extremely smart superheroes. I will never get there. And I didn't think about it. When you think it's not suited for you, you don't even try. But then I got older and I started studying math and physics, and it wasn't always easy. Languages were always easier for me, but I don't like when it's too easy.
And I was a challenge.
Yes, and I was like math and physics, and I was thinking, well, maybe I could study astrophysics. And then I got into aircraft a lot when I was 13, 14, I kept on learning about aircraft. And I went to aircraft shows.
You
and I
want the little models.
Exactly. I wanted to be a military aircraft pilot. Nice. I even did the first test when I was 17. Actually, for my 17th birthday, I got the email at midnight saying, I can now go to the first round of selection tests for a military pilot. Did not pass. But it was funny. I wasn't even like out of high school
yet. Yeah, you don't have
yet.
To, right? You can do it right when you're 17. You can start.
So yeah, I could start a round of selection, but then I needed to go to military at 18 only.
Of course.
And in the end, I had started university like 2 months later when I was still 17. So it was in a way. So and when I was in high school, we have to do a report like a thesis, and you can choose a subject. And I proposed my own subject, and I wanted to work on the history of aircrafts.
Okay.
And my tutor like said, "Oh, we could do this and work on an aircraft that exists, and maybe focus on how to build your own aircraft."
Oh la la!
And I met a really good friend of mine who's also now what we could call a co-worker from an association, Annabelle Hames, and he's an amazing guy. And basically, he is working on a project called Le Faux du Faux, where we're creating a
Le Faux du Faux.
Yeah, the fake Dufour. Dufour was the name of two brothers who actually built an aircraft that crossed Lac Léman, the lake next to Lausanne, where I grew up.
That's such a smart name.
It's a great name. It's perfect. Fels Dufour, Faux Dufour.
Yeah.
And basically, they were creating this airplane all with students. Only students are recreating every piece of the aircraft. And they're trying to basically prove it so that it's safe enough.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it's an old school aircraft, because you have to understand that we haven't been really flying before 1900.
Yeah, and that's like, what, a few years ago?
Yeah, and those people wanted to cross like Le Mans like a few years later. Mm. So it's extremely impressive. So basically, when you fly that aircraft, you get lots of oil in your face and you haven't got a window.
You're
disgusting and you're freezing anyway. Mm. But we still, like, we're working on this. And yeah, I got more and more hooked on it and history of aviation. Then I wanted to go to EPFL, so the School for Engineering, Mathematics, Physics. I still didn't know if I wanted to be an astrophysicist or an environmental engineer. And then I went to see literally every presentation for every job. I even went to listen to graphic designer job and military pilot and math and physics. And
yeah, because you don't know at that age,
you never know.
Right?
And I was very lucky to go to material science presentation. And that was the most convincing, because I love lots of things. I love sports. I love music.
Mm-hmm.
I've been playing the piano since I was 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing sports since I was a baby. So it's like all things I've been interested in. And there, it gave me the possibility to do lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me the possibility to go to aerospace industry,
mm-hmm.
or to go in, I don't know, sports shoes, or maybe environmental machines. I wanted to build things. I didn't want to just be an environmental engineer, which was presented as more somebody who analyzes data.
Mm. And then, research focus.
Yes, it's more research focused. It's more passive thing. I wanted to be an active engineer.
Yeah, you wanted to build stuff.
I wanted to build stuff. And I always thought, well, astrophysics, I can always, you know, learn on the side, which I actually did. I didn't do a big cursus, but like we had access to every university libraries in Switzerland, about 84 of them. You just had to pop an order and you would get the book 2-3 days later.
That's nice.
And I just would, every time I had holidays or weekend free.
So you self-taught astrophysics?
Not really self-taught, because I don't have a really good curriculum, but every time I would read a book, I don't know, about pulses, and I would read a word I didn't know about, and I would just get another book about the word I didn't know.
Dig deeper.
Yes, yes. I love particle physics was one of the things that I really liked. And we have what we call a CERN, C-E-R-N.
Yeah.
Which is the...
Have you been?
I've been a few times. It's in Geneva. It's 40 minutes away from me.
Oh, nice.
Right? And I wanted to work there for a while. I was like, for research and physicists, it's just such... It's so interesting and important. I actually have a book called The Lord of the Large Hadron Colliders Ring, instead of The Lord of the Ring.
Of course.
And it's so cool. For me as a nerd, this is like perfect, right?
Yeah, the wordplay, the physics, everything.
So it really helps you to keep on dreaming. And and when I was at EPFL, there were lots of conferences on black holes and gravity waves, especially in the last years.
Mm-hmm.
And aircraft companies, and Claude Nicolet, the astronaut, the only Swiss astronaut, was always presenting his life as an astronaut or as a jet pilot test. And it was, yeah, kept the flame going. Mm-hmm. And then...
So were you not tempted to do a PhD in astrophysics? Oh, I guess you didn't have a degree.
So I didn't have the degree in astrophysics. Mm. And actually, when I was in my first year of undergrad, I thought, oh, a PhD sounds good. Yeah. But it took me many years to just get a master's.
Yes.
And just before I got my master's, I was about to actually stop studying and just start working because I was really tired. And then I just taught myself, yeah, you should try it. Try to do a master's. And I applied to 3 master's. Two in aerospace engineering and one in Cambridge at materials, and I got accepted to all 3 of them.
Yeah, and you picked Cambridge.
it was a tough fight because I thought, well, you know, aerospace could be good. Mm. And then I thought, well, I can still do 1 year in Cambridge, and if I don't like it, I'd do the second master's in aerospace, and I stayed for a PhD.
Nice. So then with the space stuff, like, I mean, I obviously know everything that you've done, but now, how did you plan your journey with space? Because I know since you've been here, especially, I've seen you go to all of these talks by like astronauts, and you've done so many cool projects. Why don't you tell us a bit more, for example, the astronaut career program or Asclepios, whatever you want to start with first.
So I could start with Asclepios. So basically, to become an astronaut, you need to have multiple experiences, and the more you have projects about space, the better.
Right, so you need to have had exposure to what it means.
Exactly.
Right?
Okay. So I had exposure, I said, in high school when I did my project on how to build aircrafts, and I'm still working in that company as an airship test pilot, which is quite fun.
Oh, you need to tell us about that. As an astronaut, you need to know how to build an aircraft and things like that. That general knowledge.
I mean, you usually need to be an aerospace engineer. You don't need specifically, but it's always better to know more about space.
Yeah, because you can fix something if it goes wrong, I suppose.
You will be taught how to fix, because most things you fix before are not exactly in the ISS. But it's the kind of practical knowledge that is best to have already.
Okay,
It's easier for you, simply. And it also shows that you have massive interest, that you're not going to say, oh, I'm just trying to be an astronaut because it sounds cool. No, you actually are crazy enough that you spend 10, 15 years of your life studying it, working on it, and it proves dedication. So for me, when I studied then at EPFL, I worked with Aeropoli, which was a student-led association for aerospace. And then we just started a rocket competition with Aeropoli, but then it became the EPFL rocket team. But I barely participated in this because I was changing universities.
Right.
And then when I arrived in Cambridge last year, I was just starting my PhD, and I saw on Facebook that the Swiss Space Center was sharing an advert on how to become an astronaut. And the European Space Agency doesn't recruit often astronauts, only about every 15 years.
Yeah, I remember you saying. Yeah, that's so crazy.
I was like, wait, what's going on? Are we recruiting her then? And then I checked, and it was basically an advertisement for an analog space mission called Asclepios.
Okay.
And they were looking for 8 analog astronauts. So 6 astronauts plus 2 backups. And I was checking this, and
What's an analog astronaut?
So basically, the analog astronauts try to recreate either a lunar base or a Martian base, or the ISS, and they serve as, you could say, as lab rats. Mm-hmm. We're trying to recreate some experiments or some conditions that are analog to space or to what astronauts do feel.
Okay.
So we can test things like, I don't know, your psychological resilience, or some experiments like how easy are
whether
they?
Whether it's doable or something in these conditions.
Is it doable? Exactly. Okay. Are you going to kill your teammates for 3 months in a little tin can? This is the kind of thing, it's always, you know, you always have to fail enough so you can succeed in space.
Absolutely.
It's exactly what we do. Mm. And there's already a few analog missions that exist that are made, for instance, by NASA in Hawaii or in other bases. And they have Project Nemo, where they have, for instance, swimming pools, you know, where they go underwater.
Project Nemo, love the name.
Yeah, it's great. But what we have, what Asclepios has, is they wanted to do this, but only with students. Only students create what we call mission controls. So, you know, when you hear Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah.
Houston is the mission control. Okay.
Right.
Okay. It's those who actually, like, they hear all the communication, they transfer to the right engineers, and they solve the problem enough and they tell them what to do next.
Sure.
Okay. So I saw this advertisement and I was like, oh my God, this is so great. And I didn't think I would comment. Oh, I thought it was only for Swiss people, but it wasn't like specified. And I was like, well, I'm Swiss, but I don't really live. Tell me I can do this, please. Not the use that I just left Switzerland. Please not now.
Just distressed.
And I send them my motivation letter literally 1 hour later. I just saw it. Apparently it was the first CV that they got.
A bit keen.
I think they had just been open for one day and I was already in.
Yep.
And we have to go through four selection processes, okay, which are quite similar to the European Space Agency processes. Mm-hmm. So the first one is simply your CV and mm-hmm. motivation letter. The mm-hmm. second one is video of yourself. You have to talk and they want to see a bit how you are psychologically, like right. are you kind of friendly,
your personality,
are you able to talk, because yeah. as an astronaut you have to communicate with media. Mm. You cannot be too shy, you cannot be too, I don't know, sad on camera. You need to have a bit of charisma,
obviously,
which is something they also check on your CV. And then the phase C was actually logical and mathematical tests mm-hmm. and also a few psychological questions mm-hmm. and they just want to see how you perform under pressure. So they just give you mental calculus yeah. and yeah, see how you solve problems and how resilient you are.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth one was actually an interview with an astronaut.
So oh, nice.
And we had also psychiatric evaluation because, okay. of course, they want everyone to be safe. So mm-hmm. they don't want you to be locked for a week with a psychopath.
Obviously, imagine.
And we had a group test to see like how we communicate.
Yeah.
And yeah, so then I think it was 21st of December, I was landing in Nice for holidays mm-hmm. to see my mom and got the email saying, congratulations, you've been selected as an analog astronaut.
Oh, Santa brought your present early.
Yes, yes. And it was really funny because I landed and I had to pick up my suitcase mm-hmm. and I knew my mom was waiting for me and I was like, should I text her that I got in? Should I wait 10 minutes?
You can see her in 10 minutes.
Because I'm really
excited. The excitement is too much.
I was so excited. It was, you know, such amazing thing.
That's not super cool. You meet
people, yeah. And it's all made by students and literally took it like, they started doing this, I think, in August, mm-hmm. so 2 months before they actually started recruiting.
Oh, wow.
So that's very little time, and they managed to do so much. And we were supposed to have the mission in April 2020, mm-hmm. so 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And obviously with COVID-19, we couldn't, but we did do all the other training, actually.
Okay.
So we did extreme environment diving. We spent 4 days doing this extreme environment diving. We were sleeping by -7 degrees in the snow in tents. And we had Albin Michon, who's an explorer. He went to Antarctica. Mm-hmm. He did like 50 days in just the snow and diving into the ice and under icebergs. And he was just teaching us like how it was for him when it was hard and some survival skills. Mm-hmm. And we had like activities. We had to build an igloo and then he had to criticize it and tell us like, okay, what to do. And the reason
were you diving as well?
Yeah, we did diving. So we were in Komodana, which is a ski resort in Switzerland.
Okay.
In February. Okay. Yeah. So it was obviously frozen.
Very funny.
We had to learn how to dig a hole in the ice.
Yep.
And then we had to learn how to dive. And I never did diving before. And we're just like, oh, your first dive is going to be under the ice. Good luck.
Nice. But wait, why do you need to know how to dive in cold water?
It's not about knowing how.
Yeah, what is it? What is it for?
About your resilience.
Ah.
So for one thing,
so your
diving,
body is resilience, right?
Your mind. Maybe your mind controls the body, right?
Oh, dear. Okay.
If I tell you you're cold mm-hmm. enough, you're going to start.
You'll feel
cold.
It. Yeah, you'll think you're cold.
If
yeah.
you tell yourself you're warm, you stay warm. At least a certain amount of time. Until, yeah, you stop believing. No, so the goal of this is diving is very, apparently, similar to floating, mm-hmm. right? This is the closest we have to that mm-hmm. feeling.
Yeah.
So diving gives you maybe an idea about if you're going to like it in space, you know,
right,
being weightless.
Mm.
Yeah. So this is one of the reasons. The other is diving in ice is probably one of the really extreme things you can do, right? For most people, it's extremely uncomfortable. It's actually not that bad, but you might think it's really bad.
Mm.
If you're able to do this, and if you're able to do this with minimum training and just while you slept maybe 4 hours because there was a snowstorm going on in your tent and you ate freeze-dried food for 4 days, which is actually delicious. I really like it.
I've had the freeze-dried ice cream and stuff. It's so nice.
The best is like, I think it was the couscous I had. It was chicken couscous. It was really,
it's surprisingly good.
It's so good. I want to buy some more, actually. But some people don't like it and they don't like eating it.
For a long time you'll be like, okay, I want real food.
I mean, we had this for like 3 meals per day every yeah. day. And yeah, some people don't like it, but anyway, so this is just about you Mm-hmm. Like, maybe you get scared. I was a little bit apprehensive because I never did diving before. And, you know, I actually laughed underwater. My mask went up. I had frozen water.
Why were you laughing?
Because he was trying to get me to relax and he was making me laugh, the instructor, you know. But it was great. And then we did the same thing at night. So we went diving under ice at night and we turned off the lights.
Oh, my God.
And so you're floating under, yeah, I don't know, 15 centimeters of ice. And there's no noise and it's all dark and it's one of the most relaxing feeling ever. And that's probably how it feels to be in space.
Yeah.
You know?
But you know how now there's this whole new trend about the flotation devices?
Sensory deprivation device?
Yeah. When you sit in it and you just float. I've done it once and I started by loving it. And then you know how there's literally nothing for you to do or think about. So you just start thinking about every life decisions you've taken. And you just start stressing, but because you know how it's so easy to avoid your thoughts when there's so much going on around you. You can look at something, listen to something, eat something, touch something. But in the flotation device, it's all cut off. So is that how you fell?
No, because you're still in survival mode. I mean,
you're still trying to keep aware.
It's still very cold. I mean, it was probably, I don't know, outside temperature was probably -10 or -5. Mm. You know, when you're going to go out, you're going to have to walk 300 meters under snow in a wet thing.
The water will freeze over you.
Yeah. And I mean, your face is very, very cold. But the fact is, it's still wonderful. It's still and that's also what makes it so good. It's not like when you're in a sensory deprivation device. Mm-hmm. You're not in a life-threatening situation.
No, it's just relaxing.
It's
meant
just
to be relaxing,
which is why you have time to think. What is great when you're diving is you're still in a, you relaxed, but you're at the closest as you would be if you weren't, if you didn't have, you know, constraints such as a job, just as working out, all those abstract concepts that we created as civilization, you are back to survival mode. You're more alive than you've ever been.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It feels like, you know, when you're hungry, but a real hunger, you know? Not a stressed one. A real, things taste really good. Everything is so much, you know,
you
stronger.
Feel stuff more,
Yes, all your ears and your eyes and everything is way, way stronger and it's awesome. And it was really funny because I walked back in a diving suit. So it's what we call a dry suit. It doesn't look exactly like a wet suit. Mm-hmm. You look more like a frogman. It's really funny. So not everyone in the village knew that we were doing this.
What are these weirdos?
So in the middle of the night, I was walking with two diving bottles, gas bottles. There's a lady who was walking her dog and she saw me wearing the full dry suit. Almost with the, flippers.
With the flippers.
Carrying this in the snow. And she was like, the hell is going on?
But wait, so after you have dived into the water, dove, whatever you say, and so do you have to then go back to find the hole in the ice to go out?
So we did, it's a very small lake, and because it was about the experience and not about, exploring, because it's only a 3 meter or 2 meter deep lake. It's just about floating. We just made two holes very close to one another, and you put ropes and you just follow them. And also the instructor is holding us, so he can tell us to do it. But because the dry suits contain air, you actually almost like a tortoise on your back. You're really, really clumsy. It's so difficult to move around. So you just let yourself float.
Yeah. But you can see where the rope is, where to go, kind of thing.
It's not stressful at all.
Okay.
You also, those people are professionals. They have a diving school and they're amazing and I trust them.
Yeah, yeah.
So
you're not in danger in any way.
No, I mean, I would be if I started panicking or doing something bad. But that's the goal about being an astronaut is to know that panicking doesn't help in life-threatening situation. You just always stay calm and trust people who've got more experience.
Yeah, it's a big deal, isn't it, to trust that others are gonna and they know better.
Yeah, but I don't know, for them it was I knew that they were, of course, experts. I wasn't a better expert than they were, so of course I had to just trust them,
oh my god.
But it was great. I absolutely loved that. It was a great experience. And then a month later we actually did what we called dress rehearsal, and we simulated the mission. So what we're trying to do, a week-long mission. Now it's going to be 10 days instead of 7 days. It's going to be 10 days where we're going to be in not a tin can, but we're going to be in a tunnel where they usually do research on radioactive materials. And we're going to stay in a tunnel under a mountain, We won't be able to go out except when we do EVIs, which is called extravehicular activity. This is the term we use in space. And we're going to have to wear spacesuits. So we always have the feeling that we locked inside, that we don't have fresh air from outside, because we want to see the psychological effects and things like this. We're going to perform experiments. So the dress rehearsal was basically 48 hours where we recreated this, just so we can mess up a bit and see what are the problems and get them ready for the real mission. So for 48 hours, we're not allowed outside of not really bunker, but like underground room.
Sure.
The only problem is the toilet was outside, so every time we had to go to the loo, we had to ask for EVA for composting. We call it composting rather than going to the toilet because it was too long.
Yeah.
And we thought, because we have an experiment, we use human poop, for plants.
Nice.
Well, we thought it is technically composting. Maybe they're going to use this for later, you know, for the food we're going to have.
But a lot of people do that, you know? Like, I have a friend who lives on a boat in London and he composts his poop.
Yeah, it's a good... apparently, it smells horrible.
I mean, I can imagine.
But it works, you know. So we would say this. And it was really funny because all the food we had... We have what we call a flight plan. So from 8 o'clock in the morning or even 7 o'clock in the morning to 10 in the evening, everything is taught by... mission control.
And so they tell you what to do exactly.
And they have a webcam, we have walkie-talkies, we have direct communication with them. Sometimes they're like, do you guys want some music? So we have also exercises that we have to do. We have standard operation procedure that tell us exactly how we do stuff. And every astronaut has a specific task. It can be in group or it can be alone.
Right.
And and what's funny is the food has always a name on it. So it could be KI-16, KI-32. After 48 hours of having to ask somebody when you have to go to loo, or having to ask someone what items you can eat, when I went back, I had to take a flight the night after finishing this. So we finished at 6 o'clock, my flight was at 9. I was at the airport, I was on the phone, and I almost asked my partner, requesting EVA for composting. And I realised I didn't need to ask anyone for permission
AKA
anymore.
Can I poo?
Yeah, exactly. It was unbelievable. And then the next day, until probably 4 o'clock in the afternoon, every time I would eat something, I would look for the item number to write it down to tell to mission control. So in 48 hours, my brain had been rewired.
You're already conditioned.
Already, and it was so unbelievable. It was really funny because you would think it's annoying to have somebody tell you what to do when. It's so much easier because you don't have to take the decision. You can focus on what's important, which are experiments, which are lunch, and again, you feel way more alive by this because you don't have to be the narrator of your own life.
Oh yeah,
you're just the actor.
You
and
don't
you
have
do it fully.
To actually plan your calendar. Think how do I distribute my time over all of these tasks?
Exactly.
That must be so freeing.
It is really. I sometimes wish somebody could do that, but then I do like my freedom.
So. Oh yeah.
And also it's different when somebody it's just their job to do this.
Absolutely.
And they want the best for you, and when
it's the most efficient
way. You don't
way.
Know who's going to do this for you, right? So it was great. So this is how I got into it, and this summer I applied to Advancing X, which is a project where they will like to send four people and a parabolic flight.
Nice.
And
wait, before we go to this, with Asclepios, so your mission was meant to be in April, but it has been moved now.
Yeah.
So when will you actually do the mission?
So in February. Normally we have, I think, four trainings planned. So next weekend, we have a training about space. So we'll just have about space knowledge, about the different missions that exist, and maybe a bit of a rocket science. We have courses on public speaking and a bit of leadership. We already had some last term. And then the next one would be about, we have some diving, but we don't know if we can go because it's in France, this quarantine restrictions. So we're still waiting approval for this, depending on the COVID-19 situation. They would be repairing underground things with like jet packs, like propulsion packs.
Oh, wow.
And we would have also water drones that we can use, and
so
it would be really like the astronauts when they're in the pool trying to repair a fake ISS.
Of course,
we'd be doing something similar. Of course, not on the ISS, but it's just to give you the feeling that you're doing something underwater. You're not just diving and floating around.
Yeah,
this time
you have a
to
task.
Do the proper stuff.
Okay,
yeah.
So the point of Asclepios, is it just to have like certain trainings and then get you to do a mission after you've been trained? For people who are interested in going into space, is that how it works?
No, actually the goal of Asclepios was just first have the fun of seeing how it is to organize your own space mission as a student. Some of them might not be able to go to space. Most of us might not be able to go to space because maybe some of us have like medical conditions. Mm-hmm. We don't know, like for instance, I'm super healthy, but maybe tomorrow I do a scanner and then see that there's something wrong and I just never knew about it. And they can't afford to send someone in space at least. Mm-hmm. So for some of us, it might be the only opportunity that we have to make a simulation. It's as a student, it's very exciting because we hear people that are more or less your age and more or less the same kind of competences or not too far. So it's less probably intimidating.
Yeah.
And I said, ESA recruits only every 15 years.
Yeah.
So yes, it's an opportunity to make your own mission. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity to be part of something
it's
bigger
an adventure,
than you.
Isn't it?
It's an adventure, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, why do you join an association? You love space and you're with people who want the same dream.
Yeah.
And already our students, instead of going partying or in the club, do you actually, you know, go in a... Well, you can do both. But you have a bit less time if you do the mission. And it's just the people who are ready to commit and work for this. And just being with a team like that is so amazing. It's rare to find...
That's
so many people
cool.
who are committed and want the same thing. Mm. You know, shared... Like, as you said, you... barely met anyone who was serious about space.
Yeah.
And suddenly you meet, I don't know, 100 people.
I'm not the only one.
Yes. And it's one of the greatest things when you can share a passion and not just share about talking, but actually doing something
together. You're doing it together.
Yeah, yeah.
So I really hope your mission happens in February.
So I think in February it'll be fine.
Okay.
The main problem is just the trainings that we have in November and in December.
Okay.
These are the two main things, which are extreme environment training. And they might be simply scrapped and then we only go for the mission.
So you're part of the first batch of people
yes.
who did this.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really exciting.
We're the first, but so we call Genesis actually because of this.
Of course.
The next Asclepios 2 will take place next year. They started the recruitment this summer. I was helping with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supposed to do their test in October and we had to postpone it just for
Yeah.
You know, obviously safety reasons, but they've got, I think, 18 astronauts left and they have to select a few of them.
Oh,
so
nice.
Really excited for them and wish them good luck. And it's sad because we were supposed to train at least one weekend together, but...
Maybe that won't happen now.
But we probably mentor them as...
You will after you're done.
Ex-astronauts.
Yeah. The older lot.
Exactly, no, and that's also exciting, you know, just because we also have to file reports about how it went for us and then they can learn from this. There's already a mission report from... what we did so far and they could already study this for their admission exam.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
So okay, now given that we are here to talk about women doing different things, what was the kind of ratio between women and men in these programs?
So basically Asclepios wanted to have four women and four men.
Okay. So 50-50.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And actually when people applied, I think it was 42% of women and 50% of men.
So very close.
Maybe more. I'm not 100% sure about the numbers. It was quite high. And this year was actually even higher.
Oh wow.
And I think they got more women selected, I think, so far, but I'm not 100% sure. But we had a massive amount of women interest, which is really great. And but right now for my mission, our two backups are men. So we have three women, three men for the main team, and we have two backups who are men. But it was just because of the candidates.
Yes.
One of them couldn't come from, I think, Brazil because of visa reasons, so that's why.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But no, it's actually space is, I think, an interest for everyone. It's not, there's a gender change, as in, that before you would have mainly male astronauts.
Yeah.
You still have a lot of male astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
But the interest itself and the fact to look at the stars is not that difficult for girls in the end.
So you think that, for example, Asclepios, they are definitely making an effort to make sure that representation is there?
Yeah, yeah, they
okay.
do. They do. And for instance, both of the heads are women.
Okay.
And they absolutely amazing and they do an amazing job. And also for the communication, they really make sure that it's for everyone. They've done a good work at making people understand that women can do everything.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes. Yeah.
And so do they pay for everything? For example, when you go to Switzerland for something, do they pay for it?
So if I have to take a flight just for Asclepios, yes, they do.
Oh, they do.
But I'm not paid to do the work.
No.
It's all voluntary, but they will cover as much as they can. obviously I shouldn't pay for, like, get some champagne on the flight or like go for a road trip around Switzerland and make them pay for gas. That is
go business class or something.
Exactly. So no, they pay for
but
this.
They cover,
but it's all sponsors. It's all sponsor based. So it's completely non-profit. So yeah, last year we had a few different sponsors also for the location. We need obviously to work with people. So for instance, I was working with a startup company who makes sensors and they agreed, for instance, to work with us. Sometimes the sponsorship comes not just in money but actually in, like, in goods. So for instance, we had vegan cookies because we had to eat vegan for a month before the mission, and during the mission we have to eat vegan. And
why is that?
The reason for this is when you got, we're simulating a lunar base.
Yes.
Okay. We're not just on the ISS, we're actually on the moon. Yes. On the moon you will never have cows. There's no space. If we ever manage to terraform the moon, we will not have a priority to have
to get cows on there. Yeah,
maybe chicken, maybe, but like it's just way too much conversion, right? I think you have 1 kilo of cow, you need about 8 kilo of soya.
Yeah,
so it's not just too much sustainable.
Yeah.
So on the long run, they thought, well, it's more sustainable if we do it vegan. But some of us were not vegan already. One of our astronauts was, and the two other were vegetarian, and I'm flexitarian.
Yeah.
But so that our mood wouldn't be too affected, we had to go vegan for a month just to see the effect.
You're used to it.
Yes, and we have actually a nutritionist that actually measures what we eat, and we have to say, I'm feeling a bit, you know, tired, or actually I have enough, or
I
too
need
much.
More protein.
Exactly, you have to say about what you have. And yeah, so we had vegan cookies, actually.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Because I was just thinking, even that you take, the astronauts take all the food from Earth to there, so it wouldn't make much difference as to what food you're sending. But I suppose they are planning ahead in terms of futuristic.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool.
Actually, this week was the International Astronautical Federation Conference 2020.
Okay.
And this, today again, and the 2 days before was actually the Mars Society Conference 2020. Mm-hmm. So the whole week was conference about space. It was fascinating. And they are really talking about how we're going to go to Mars. And it's so exciting. They were talking about how we're going to have a moon base and going to be a gateway between the moon and Mars, and how is this going, how are we going to terraform Mars, how would we do it, how would society change, if they would send more engineers to start with, or would they already send different collection of people. So we're getting there. It's very exciting because it's been developing really quickly the recent years.
Yeah, and you won't know unless you actually look at what they're doing, right?
Yeah, you can see a few things if you like listen
dig
a bit.
Yeah.
You don't need to dig that much anymore because space enthusiasm is coming back, really. I think after the moon landings, and so I think the last moon landing was what, 1974, I think. I'm not sure. But basically after this, people lost interest a lot.
Yeah.
And
it became
funding
old
went
news,
down.
Right.
It got old news, and there wasn't really a drive to do it anymore. People had gone to the moon and didn't see the interest of having a moon base. Now that people are thinking going to Mars, having a moon base is
it's gonna
step.
Be cool.
Yeah. So it's super exciting.
Right. Okay. You were going to tell us about the other project now.
Yeah. So Advancing X.
Yeah.
So basically, I saw this online. I've been looking a lot of analog missions because I'm organizing the first edition of Analog Space Mission Conference because I would like to bring the Analog Space Mission community together. I want analog astronauts to know one another. I want us to exchange about the experiments we do. One thing is that it's not redundant. And if it is redundant, that actually we can compare the values and see, okay, we had different criteria, parameters, and maybe that changed in this and this. And I was looking at analog missions, and suddenly I found Advancing X. And I look at the project and they were like, oh, we're sending astronauts to space. And I saw worldwide competition. NASA is restricted to American astronauts.
Yeah.
And ESA recruits only every 15 years. So you can't go to space that easily.
No.
There's a mission called Project Possum. I think for £5,000 you get training, and I think you can be sent on a public flight, but £5,000 is a lot of money.
That's a lot of money, yeah.
And this one basically said, well, it's open to everyone, every country. And we will send 4 people. And the criteria is actually, well, obviously your CV and other things.
Yeah.
But it's also they want to have the optimal team. For me, when I work with my mission askapios, with my astronauts, we're all very different. We all have different personality types. We all have different ways of thinking or subjects of interest. Mm-hmm. We all love space and we all want to make this happen.
Yeah.
So when we were doing our extreme environment workshop, you don't have to tell anyone what to do. They just do it.
Oh, that's great.
And you've been on group projects. You know how painful it is sometimes.
When you have to chase somebody.
When they have to chase you. Mm. When you, one is, for instance, I do all the work the first week and some people do it at the last minute.
Mm.
It's very difficult. When you have 6 or 8 people who work seamlessly when they haven't really spent time before together and don't know each other, it's one of the greatest gifts. And for me, the opportunity to have an optimal team together, selected by psychological tests, you know, and where you train for, like, basically we are going to train, so there will be diving and geological experiments and things like this. And basically they would take the 4 that match the best.
Mm-hmm.
And then these 4 will go in a
super hospital. Like 4 people who work best together and who bring in different skills.
Exactly. Ah. Exactly. And so I thought, well, why not try? I won't go on the ISS. Mm-hmm. I won't go to Mars. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not a plan, but normally it's just a suborbital flight.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's still a massive experience.
So when is that going to be?
So the training will start normally next year.
Okay.
I mean, it was a bit delayed because of COVID. And also I have to basically tell my availability because of the PhD. I have, you know, obviously. to wait a bit. But it's normally in the next 4 or 5 years and hopefully in 5 years we get the final.
Oh, wow. Part.
Yeah.
So you'll actually go into a ship.
If I'm selected.
Yeah.
So I need to be part of this team of 4 people.
Right.
So still a bit away to go, but still, you know, even if I don't get there, the path is as interesting as the
yeah, the training, the experience, everything would add up together.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, that's super cool. Okay. And I mean, from what I understand, like, you were generally interested in a lot of things and then it finally led you to space. But would you say that there were certain specific people along the way that kind of shaped your interest more?
Shaped my interest. Yes.
Or inspired you?
So inspired me, I think some of my teachers were like some of the biggest inspiration. My piano teacher was a really great inspiration because she just taught me how to work well.
Okay.
And she could be really hard but at the same time extremely supportive and made massive progress thanks to her, and it was really great, and we have still a great bond. I had a really good math teacher when I was young who actually told my mother, oh, you know, she should maybe like skip a class, you know, instead of like being bored, but actually, you know, do a bit more. And that was really great to just have the trust of a teacher. And later on, and still now, I mean, I have Annabel Hames, with whom I did my high school project. I have some of my teachers instead of having an EBL too. I had really, really great teachers that were just fascinated by the project and always happy to share about this, and this was so great, you know, to have people who were in love with what they do. You know, off, you might have that comment sometimes that people tell you that you're weird because you like math.
Yeah.
And these people are like you, they also may be weird and they also love math. And it's great to share this. So I've been really inspired by people like this, and then also was given the chance by others, for instance, to come to Cambridge, was given the chance to come here and get support. So I would say those people, and the people that I don't personally know are sometimes reading like accounts by astronauts help. Some astronaut, when you read their account, you think, oh my god, this is, they're perfect. I bet their hair is always perfect and their skin is always perfect.
Yeah.
And for instance, if you read Scott Kelly's book, who's one of the twin astronauts, so there's Mark and Scott Kelly, who were twin astronauts, and they perform an experiment on them. One stayed on Earth and the other one left for you. And they actually did some great research on the change in genetic code of one of the two.
Oh, wow. Twins.
Yeah, because this is one of the most incredible experiments you can do. This is the best way to know if we're going to be affected by long-term missions, right? And he wrote a book, and it's funny because in my life I was not always the best student. I did not always, you know, get the best grade right away. Had a few failed exam, a few years lost. And I read Scott Kelly's book, and in it there's a description when he went to high school, he was not paying attention, again, not good grades. He tried to go to military school because he actually wanted to become a jet pilot and maybe an astronaut. Mm-hmm. And for once in his life, he had one dream and one reason to work hard. Yeah. And he went to that school, and the guy said, "I'm sorry, but no." And I almost cried. I was on the plane reading this, and I almost cried. And then I was like, well, he failed too, and he still went up there. Mm. So this was one of the most inspiring moments. It was the day I understood that astronauts are not perfect people.
No.
They are you, they are me. They're just people who keep believing and they keep on working hard.
Mm.
And this, in everything you do, if you have a dream, if you have the one chance, which not everybody has, if you have the one chance to have a dream, you should always go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't listen to what your family says if they're not supportive,
mm-hmm.
or your friends say if they don't understand your dream, mm-hmm. or what society says. Follow people who inspire you,
mm-hmm.
and follow like teachers that actually trusted you,
mm-hmm.
and go for it.
Yeah.
And that's like the best advice I can
give. That's a very good advice. Like, honestly, mm-hmm. yeah, it's true. You always get like, unless your dream is something classic that everyone knows of, it's always a bit like, but why do you want to do that?
Yeah, they don't, especially I think, as astronaut, I had once this discussion with one of my supervisors in APFL. I told him, I think I want to be an astronaut. He was like, oh, I would never do that because I wouldn't like bear not taking a shower for a month. And I was like, really? Shower? That's your limit?
That's why you don't want to be an astronaut?
I mean, that you're scared that you might die, that it's a lot of work. But a shower? This is where you draw the line.
Yeah, apparently. But also, I feel like, okay, if someone is telling you they want to do something and you can't relate with that, doesn't mean they shouldn't do it.
No, it's true. But sometimes they will tell you it's too hard and you, because they themselves will never commit that much.
No.
I mean, like, for instance, I was in discussion with a friend last year who also wants to be an astronaut. And I was like, we're probably the only kind of person who know we might get cancer from going to space from all the radiation. And we're still...
And you're okay with it.
We're okay with it. We're that crazy, you could say crazy, that we're okay with making that sacrifice.
It's a bargain that you're happy to take, you know?
Yes, it is. And that's what you have to know. And when you meet people who are ready to do that bargain with you, it really helps because you spend a long time of your life not meeting people like that.
Yeah, then you don't feel crazy, right?
No. Or even if you are, at least you're happy to share.
I'm not the only one.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's great. But I mean, obviously I know you and I know why you're so excited about space, but what actually excites you about space? What makes you think that, oh my god, being an astronaut is going to be the best thing in my life?
Have you seen Rocket Lounge?
No, I haven't.
Even in video, you never seen one in video?
I have seen. Okay. I have seen like little bits.
So I've never seen one in live.
Okay. Sadly.
But I've seen it once. I went to a conference by Marc Toussaint.
Mm-hmm.
He was working on Ariane 5 rockets.
Okay.
And we were in an auditorium for 400 people, mm-hmm. and he put a full volume blast off of a rocket.
Oh, lovely.
And the whole auditorium was shaking.
It was shaking, I can imagine.
It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It's like when I look at planes when they like take off and land, for me, it always gives me like butterflies and like
the adrenaline.
And stars in my eyes.
Yeah.
And this is the same. And I'm like, I want to sit on top of this thing.
Mm.
I want to sit there. Why do I want to be an astronaut? It's not just about, you know, the amazing view you have from Earth. It's not about... the fact that you learn so much about yourself, not only because you're in an extreme environment, but because you're far away from Earth. You understand how insignificant you are, how small you are compared to Earth, and yet how much you managed to achieve as the human race. You know, you got to space. And the other thing is, I really like the fact that you're making Earth a better place and space a better place. All the experiments that you do on board of the ISS, or you do as an analog astronaut, or you would do on the moon, would actually help. We don't realize, and often people are like, why are we even financing this? Why? Because a lot of the medication are produced there, but all the analysis that we do there, a lot of the things are understood thanks to space. A lot of, for instance, climate change, satellites actually helped us realize how much we had an impact.
Mm-hmm.
They help us monitor catastrophes, they help us monitor changes. So there's so much you can learn from space,
mm-hmm.
and it's your one chance to be like you completely dedicated to the human race. And as much as the human race can really be annoying, it's still your home, it's still your family, it's still your friends, and you want the best for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the best way to give everything back while doing science, while sitting on a little bomb-fueled rocket and while seeing the best view you will ever see in your life. It's the whole thing. And I even like the training, which is such a bonus. If I hated the training, I wouldn't enjoy
that. That shows that you really want to do it.
Yes.
But yeah, and also there's so much that's unexplored and unknown about space. Yeah. There's so much that we can still do.
Yes. That's really exciting. Yeah. Mm. For instance, when I think of Mars, I was often against, you know, terraforming for Mars. I think we need to make sure there's no life on Mars before we actually get there,
mm-hmm.
because we might actually kill the life that's there.
Exactly.
So we have to be really careful. And yes, I was often thinking, should we really go there? Mm. But part of me thinks a bit like, I don't know, you know, like a child who's got a sandpit.
Yeah.
And you've got it all for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you can build any castle you want.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you dig in and you find a little rock, and it's a really nice rock. It's exactly this, but way bigger.
Yeah.
You can play God. You mm-hmm. can play, you can create things from nothing, and you can create new machines. You can explore mm-hmm. the geology. You will see different sunrise and sunset. This is so exciting. It's like really probably the explorer inside every human that might be like shivers a bit thinking of this. This is a new, very big sandpit that I can play.
And also it's a bit of like every basic things that you've done, you will do it there, and it's different and it's for the first time.
Yes, and that's what's exciting. It will be extremely tiring, but at the same time, having so much that is new, it's so crazy. Even like just thinking about how you're going to breathe or build things, you have to be creative about everything you do. It's amazing. And it's this, the fact that it's all about your survival and makes it even more real. I think it gives a really much more purpose to people.
Absolutely.
You know, rather than not realizing why are you doing this job every day just to pay money to something that seems not really like that you can't really feel and perceive, mm-hmm. because everything becomes so abstract because we're such a big society. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Instead, now you know exactly. You know, well, if I don't do my job, I can't breathe and I can't eat. So easy peasy.
I have to do it.
I work for myself.
Yeah.
As well as other people, you know. But it's way easier to understand your purpose that way.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That's a good way of thinking about it. Oh, that's super cool. So what's the plan now, like post-PhD? How are you going to make it concrete now?
Oh, so apparently the applications are going to open very soon.
Ooh, the 15-year.
Yeah, it was supposed to be 2024. It might be actually earlier. Said in its space that it's going to be early 2021.
Okay.
I'm not ready. My CV is not ready. I needed to finish my PhD.
Yeah.
But depending on the criteria, I will probably apply anyway, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. it would be stupid not to try.
Yeah, why not, right?
And depending on what happens, maybe I'll be an astronaut in a few years.
So that's going to be the first step.
That will be the first step. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you should always have a job on the side.
Absolutely.
The reason is, for instance, imagine I'm selected astronaut. Mm. It takes you years before you're assigned to a mission. Two, 3 years of training, then maybe you have to wait 3-4 years before you get your mission.
You've got a mission, yeah.
So you're not an astronaut tomorrow.
Yeah.
You're not going to see me flying tomorrow. However, you need a job on the side.
Absolutely.
And you need something that you like. And if tomorrow I'm assigned a mission and I get shot by a car and I break both legs, I'm probably not going to go to space.
No.
And if it's forever, then, you know. So you always have to have your own job.
Mm-hmm.
And I love material science. So maybe I'll try, if I do manage to publish a few things, postdoc, or maybe I'll work in the aerospace industry, mm-hmm. maybe for the European Space Agency, depending. They sometimes offer postdocs, so depending if they have something interesting.
Mm.
Yeah, mm. yeah. And also what I would really like to do is like work on space law.
Okay, what's that?
So basically, I was really worried now that we're going back to Mars. Oh, going to Mars.
Going back
to the moon, not in going for the first time to Mars, at least human. I'm really worried that people will go there as individuals and not as a community.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to have a second chance of a second planet,
mm-hmm.
we should try to go there together as the human race, hand in hand, and make progress and help Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I was thinking, well, we need to find all the old treaties that are for space, make sure that they're updated, make sure that there's no war, that there's no problems between Space Force and other, well, no, it's not named Space Force anymore, now it's the Netflix show, but you know what I mean, that we don't have conflicts between this. And now, actually, this week, they announced that during the conference, they signed the Artemis Accord, and it's basically nine countries that sign a contract that basically they wouldn't, they would try to be sustainable and work hand in hand.
So they won't compete.
Yeah, not compete too much, like actually make progress together. I haven't read the full accord, but basically it's still very exciting. And yes, I was really interested in working on this, although I'm not a lawyer, but like maybe give my insight as you know, an astronaut, and try to find a way to work on this all together. And for instance, what we're doing with Askapios, which is really exciting, is I found some people that worked in, they had a semester project in the Netherlands for university, where they were working on space law, basically, and just thinking about, they were working with the UN and thinking about what they could find for space laws. And I told them, well, could we do a workshop during the mission? And we just simulate like maybe a war, and we look at what happens with the astronauts. So like, imagine there's a conflict between, I don't know, we have an astronaut who's from Chile. Imagine Chile and Switzerland start a war. And, I don't know, Chile tells the astronaut, you have to sabotage the mission. And Switzerland says, you have to save the mission at what cost. What do the two astronauts do? Are you going to be loyal to your country? Are you going to be loyal to the mission? Are you going to try to save yourself? We want to see how people react. And then I want everyone to sit down and just say, okay, what is important to us as astronauts? If you're going to be on Mars, I don't think countries are going to count anymore, right?
You're on different planets.
You're going to be on a different planet. There's going to be a new set of demarcation, and we need to understand what is the priority. Is the priority to, like, you save a mission, or that you save yourself? What needs to be protected? Like, does the country have a more, how say, a higher priority? Than your order orders, and will you really follow them? Like, well, should they be a clause that once you leave a certain perimeter of Earth, that you don't obey Earth anymore? That you are now your own judge and governor, and you just have to respect some rules? And this is the kind of thing that I find really interesting, and I think extremely important, just so we don't start having wars on Mars. Especially, we're going to try to survive. We should not spend time fighting over resources.
Let's start with peaceful.
So this is something I would be very interesting on working on. And
That's actually really cool. I like this discussion about, you know, once you are leaving planet Earth, you're not really associated. You are all from different countries, but you're all representing Earth. So you should all be on the same team. And the fact that you're interdependent on each other as well while you're on space, you don't want to be enemies.
We actually almost had a logo. So we have, you know, Thyskopius, we have our own jackets with our names and the mission and everything. Really cool. We like them bomber jackets, you know.
What's the name of your mission?
So Genesis, yes.
Genesis,
because
we're
the first edition. And basically, we almost put, instead of our flags from our country, so you had to choose, I chose Switzerland, for instance, for my country. Some chose France or whichever. And we almost put, I think it's called international flag, but it's basically the flag that represents everyone. The Earth. And we thought that would be actually
That would have been a good message.
Just that we're all in this together, and as nations, but actually as that's one thing. So maybe the next mission they'll take that flag.
That should be your advice for the next mission.
I mean, it has to be up to them, you know. One thing that is nice when you have your own flag is that you can say, well, we plurinational, you know, just all from Switzerland, although it was created in Switzerland, but still from everywhere. And that's also really cool.
Representation.
So it's just, it's also a way to say, well, we united to do something together.
So question, alien, do you believe in them or not? Do you think there's some form of life in space?
It's not a question of believing. It's a question of, I don't know yet. For everything, it's like you could say, I don't know, like every physical, like for instance, black holes. Okay, I don't believe in them. I know there's some because some scientists found them.
There's evidence.
Somebody finds alien, I won't have to believe in them. They there or they're not there. And I believe there's a probability that they exist.
I know, right?
But I don't know.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And I don't want
to... You have to go find them.
Yeah, I'm not going to start praying to know you and just hoping that they exist. I will just wait for the proof. But yeah, to be honest, I expect that... I wouldn't be surprised in the next 100 years we actually do find some bacteria mm-hmm. or some, you know, virus or something that is akin to life, mm-hmm. but is simply from another planet. Yeah. Mm. That wouldn't be a surprise. However, finding an alien way we can communicate or that we can think, oh, it's an animal or something like this, I don't think we're going to have that chance. I think the universe is probably way too big.
Yeah, probably way too big.
But I'm not an astrophysicist. I'm only a fanatic.
So. Self-taught fanatic.
So I have no numbers and no knowledge of this. So I can't tell. It's just what I think will happen.
Obviously, yeah. So now, as an ending note, what would you advise any, you know, young girls in school or any age that who are interested in space and who don't know where to start? What do you wish you knew when you were younger that might have made your journey quicker or easier in any way?
That space camps exist.
Nice.
And in Europe they don't exist that much. Okay. But I was really surprised when I learned that people could do space camps. I only heard about them I think 2-3 years ago.
Okay.
Apparently they're really, really cool.
I can imagine.
Yeah. If you can do this, it could be a good thing. Mm-hmm. The main thing is just try to connect as much as you can with people who love space.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, when you're 13 or 14, I wouldn't tell you to go on Facebook and join groups. There's lots of really good groups, but yeah. I wouldn't push you to go on social media,
mm-hmm.
but have a look at what NASA does. Mm-hmm. Have a look, take as many books as you can,
mm-hmm.
Listen to talks,
mm-hmm.
ask your parents, can I go and see a rocket launch? Or could you please connect me with people who love space?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a member of the Swiss Space Museum. Like I was helping once or twice with exhibition,
mm-hmm.
and I would work with people maybe 6 hours or 2 days in a row. I had never met them before, and some were 20, some were 50 or 60 or even 70 years old, some were artists or not. And what was common is we all love space. And if you can share this with someone, it really helps you. So my advice is find people to share your dream with,
mm-hmm.
and don't be ashamed of it. You know, it's your dream, it's your own thing. If people despise you for it or make fun of you for it, don't listen to them. They suck. They don't have a dream, okay?
Exactly.
You can pity them and tell them, well, I'm sorry that you don't have something that keeps you up at night and makes you dream and believe, you know? And yeah, also when you fall, if you fall, mm-hmm. but I hope you fall because it's a great lesson.
Agreed.
Not too hard though, just enough that you learn something.
Yeah.
Always get back up, okay? Mm-hmm. Even in the darkest moment when you think you lost your dream, always prepare future you. Always make the effort for future you, because future you is going to thank past you for the actions that you took to get you to that dream. Even when you lost your dream and lost belief that you will ever get there, still take the extra step to get there. And it will keep the momentum going. And if you don't like your dream anymore, that's also fine. Mm-hmm. That's not a problem.
Yeah, but your dreams can change.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But at least make sure that past you did everything for future you so that you have the choice of continuing that dream or not. Don't close the door too early. Yeah. Okay. That's my advice.
Oh, that's really nice. Well, hello, thank you for being here today. I had a lovely time. I thought I knew everything about your space exploration, but I've learned so many new things. I hope this was fun for you too.
It was really great. As I said, it's always nice to share a dream.
You came to the right place.
I did. Thank you so much for having me.
No, that's great. So I hope your mission goes on in February, and then maybe we can have you back and we can hear all about the mission very soon.
Yes, maybe I'll give you an account and then you can all sleep well of my boring accounts.
Exactly. Perfect. Well, thank you.
Thanks to you. Have a lovely day.
Thank you. You too. Bye.